Members, we're not going to officially start with adopting minutes and so forth, but out of respect for the people that are here, we're here on time, we're going to start off. So we've got first on our docket, Commissioner Clyburn, welcome to the committee. If you can step forward. Tapes are rolling, correct? The tape is rolling? Yeah, okay. All right, good. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. My name is Joanna Clyburn. I am the Commissioner of Minnesota IT Services.
And Commissioner, just so you know, when we do get a quorum, I will be officially calling us to order. So I'll need to pause you at that moment. So please proceed.
Absolutely. So, Madam Chair, members, I come to the Office of Commissioner with a background in organizational management and multidimensional leadership. I'm an attorney by training. I'm a small business owner and a partner in my own law firm. Additionally, I have over 28 years of military service for our great country and state. I currently serve as a Brigadier General in the Minnesota Army National Guard. I'm a combat veteran of the Operation Iraqi Freedom and have deployed with the 34th Infantry Division. While I do not have experience coding or running the software personally, I do have experience in leadership positions in high-pressure environments, overseeing technology and cybersecurity, and managing diverse teams as they work to untangle and resolve complex, ill-defined problems. When Governor Dayton asked me to take this position, he gave me four directives: fix MNLARS, deliver real ID, ensure MNIT is providing premier centralized IT services to our state agency partners and is directed by the legislature, as well as to improve our state cybersecurity posture. Which brings me to the first agenda item today, MNIT's handling of the MNLARS system. As it relates to MNLARS, my commitment is this. You will receive from me an unvarnished assessment of how I see the situation. I do not sugarcoat. I will be accountable to deliver to you the answers to the questions you ask and to arm you with whatever information is needed to make informed decisions. I will honor my commitments to you and will inform you when the situation on the ground changes, be it for better or worse. I regret that my first appearance before your committee occurs against the backdrop of the urgent request for MNLARS funding, but the reality of the situation demands it. MNIT and DPS are requesting $10 million be appropriated this week from existing DPS special revenue funds for the use on improving and completing the build of MNLARS. While this request is not officially before this committee does have jurisdiction over my agency. So I need to be very clear that if no action is taken today, it indicates, or that the legislature indicates that these funds will be made available, we will have to provide contractually obligated notices to the information technology contractors working on improving the vehicle system in order to ensure that we can meet the commitment for Real ID. And let me be clear again, I will not fail to deliver Real ID on time as promised. Without the required funding, it will have a crippling effect on the progress we are making. If I have to ramp down even for a short period of time, it will have a snowball effect on my ability to ramp back up and in a timely and productive manner. It will affect my ability to retain those with the expertise and the skills to make the system work. And it will essentially leave a status quo for the time being. So what is the status of the MNLARS system right now? MNLARS currently handles title transactions, vehicle registration, and financial transactions, and administers more than 1,500 different fees for the state of Minnesota. Roughly 18,000 vehicle registrations are being successfully processed through MNLARS on a daily basis. Total, the system has processed nearly 4.5 million transactions and has collected over $900 million in revenue for the state since July 2017. And thanks to the very hard work of DPS, the backlog of titles has been reduced from the height of roughly 380,000 in early December to approximately 210,000 today. We have transitioned over 5,000 system users to MNLARS, including DVS staff, deputy registrars, dealers, law enforcement, who are now using the system every day. Law enforcement now has up-to-date information on vehicles on the road, as deputy registrars are providing a huge service by updating records in real time. This process used to take 2 to 3 months to be updated, and all the work had to be done by DVS. In launching MnLARS, we converted more than 6 million motor vehicle titles and registration records from the mainframe of MnLARS without interruption to the driver services function that continue to operate off of the legacy system. But these numbers, while encouraging, obscure a more complicated reality behind the scenes. Deputy registrars continue to struggle with time-consuming workarounds and a set of transaction types that simply cannot be accommodated by the system at this time. They also deal with the frustration of stakeholders, of the public, the auto dealers, and other individuals. We hold them accountable for the system limitations of which they have no control. Ms. Dana Bailey has been traveling the state to hear from stakeholders and provide regular updates on the status of the progress. The Minute team, being led by Ms. Joan Redwing since late November, has delivered needed fixes, features, and improvements at a steady clip that are significantly better in the quality than what has been previously released. In total so far, 101 features and fixes have been implemented successfully in 5 releases since November 8, 2017. I have made it clear that testing standards must be maintained and at an extremely high level. Fixing one problem while creating 2 other ones is entirely unacceptable. Ms. Redwing has implemented what is known as business-driven end-user testing, acceptance testing with complete transaction coverage before and after releases. With the exception of one 15-minute outage, the system has been stable since November, and the response times have been greatly improved compared to the time previously. But while fixes and features are being delivered consistently, they are not being delivered at the pace that users and stakeholders would like to see. There's no doubt that we are failing on this project. In my very limited time in this role, it's very obvious to me that there have been lapses in oversight, testing, quality assurance, and project management have all played in rolling out a system that was simply not ready to go live. I can assure you that I am doing everything in my power as commissioner to get to the bottom of what went wrong, to ensure people are held accountable, lessons are learned, and to ensure processes are changed. As I meet with my team to get up to speed on the multitude of aging IT systems that we use on a daily basis to conduct our work, it's clear to me that the scope of modernization of these projects of this size and scope will continue on within the state for many more years. Not only do we need to make the situation right, but we need to learn how to fix and ensure this stuff does not happen again. Accountability, responsibility, and processes are all key to this. That said, it's also critical that we not let a focus on what went wrong paralyze us in the face of the ongoing challenges. We know we need to fix and complete MnLARS systems, have released a roadmap to do that, and we stand before you today acknowledging the challenges we have faced. But I'm also prepared to have a tough conversation on what we need to do to fix it. We don't want to continue to admire the problem, but come forward with solutions. The MnLARS roadmap is not just analysis of new IT leadership, but recommendations of Microsoft Premier support, the input of the deputy registrars, auto dealers, and stakeholders. But the truth is, ultimately, having faith in any project or process, or organization for that matters, comes down not to the faith of the individuals involved, which I do have in the current leadership teams, but asking the hard questions, even when we don't like the answers. I've been asking the hard questions, and I am able to track gains and progress and where we need to work. But here are some of the hard questions I've had to ask. How is Minute providing oversight of IT projects within the current structure and tracking day-to-day, month-to-month progress? What reporting currently occurs up the chain to Minute leadership, and how do I know it is accurate? This question seems particularly relevant considering the report on your agenda today. This report shows a status for MnLARS as being yellow. The project is coded by the project leadership as yellow in October of 2017, an indication to me that project leaders were either not keeping information in the project tracking system up to date or not accurately reporting. And that is completely unacceptable. And I can assure you today, sadly, the project is in red. Ultimately, when the legislature consolidated IT, I believe you expected that all IT projects would be tracked and overseen at the highest levels of leadership in the organization. From what I have learned in my first few weeks, it's clear that oversight of application development projects still largely occur in a federated system. While operational IT services have been consolidated, there have been limited consolidations on the application level. This is where most of the projects in our portfolio occur, and there are undoubtedly reasons for this approach. Restrictions on the use of federal dollars that go into IT work or the need for this type of project management to occur alongside of our business partners to be effective. But recent failings to Minlars underscores for me that there is a need for more rigorous oversight at a level above the local agency Minute team. Minute staff working in local agency offices are incredibly committed and dedicated. But my assessment is at another level of oversight, which will be critical as the state faces major IT modernization projects in the years ahead. It is my responsibility to ensure that we restore the trust with you and the citizens of Minnesota in order to be successful in IT projects in the future. I intend to live up to that responsibility, but I also look forward to hearing from you today what you believe is required to restore that trust and how we work together moving forward to do what's right for the state of Minnesota. And I appreciate the opportunity, although I'm sure it will not be easy today, to testify in front of you. I am happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. With that, members, we have quorum. I'm going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order. Members, in your packets, you have the minutes from February 28th. If Representative Green wants to move the minutes.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Green moves the minutes for February 28th. All those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the minutes are adopted. Okay, I think what we're going to do here, I just want to double check to see if there's anybody from the audience that wants to offer input for us before we go into any questions for the commissioner. Is there anyone that wishes to offer any testimony on this issue? Okay, seeing none with that, Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair and General. Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Wanted to preface any questions that I asked by saying I appreciated our conversation earlier. And as I stated on that conversation, you and I have a blank slate. You've been given a very difficult and tenuous position to come into, but I agree with your assessment that Minlars is in the red. It's bad. From day one, it was not functional and has been heavily impacting people around the state. Deputy registrars, end users, dealers, auctioneers, it has created a critical position for many of them, many of whom are using their personal funds to keep their doors open because the software that we require that they use doesn't work. They're losing money. They're mortgaging their homes. They are taking money out of savings, and that is despicable. It's our job to fix that, and I have a lot of questions, and some of them I gave to you earlier in the day, but I have others. A letter was submitted to you by Chair Torkelson and Chair Baker. You provided answers to them, so we're going to go to that first, and particularly question number 5, which has a fairly detailed list of questions, and I assume we have those. Every member has those.
Members, in your packet, the letter that he is referring to is February 23rd of 2018. It's addressed to Representative Torkelson and Representative Baker. So we're on page 5, on page 3, item number 5. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, and again, this is something that you inherited, but Mr. Eichten's with you, so there's the phone-a-friend option, as we call it here in our committee. I've asked a lot of questions that are sort of a historical assessment of how we got to where we are going, because I think that that's truly something that you would agree on. In order for us to understand what we have to do to fix it, we should understand how we got there. My question starting is, one of the first answers is, there is a lack of adherence to architectural principles in the development process.
Representative Nash, pause for a moment. If you have a cell phone or a microphone, you can please remove that. Great. Thank you. Appreciate it. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back at it. I get a lot of questions from people that says, Jim, I have no idea what you're saying. You're just blathering on in IT words, and while we appreciate geek speak, can you please make it real? So I do my best, and my question or my answer to many people is, consider you're building your dream lake cabin, and you have an architect create a blueprint for what the end product is going to look like. And you all agree that that's what's necessary to get from inception point to finish point. And somewhere along the way, someone decides, without talking to the architect or the project manager, that, you know, that bathroom and that big bay window that you have, we're really not going to put it where it is. We're going to make a decision, and we're going to put it on the front of the house so your big bay window looks into the trees instead of over the lake. From the answer that you've given, that's essentially what's happened during the build-out process of this. My question for this particular answer is, why did that happen? Where was the management? Who was responsible for that? And what's being done as a result of that? Because, again, not to dig too much into the forensic background of this, but we need to know that this isn't going to happen again, and we need to know also why in the heck it happened to begin with, because, you know, I want to look out the bay window over the lake, not into the trees.
Commissioner or Ms. Redwing?
Madam Chair, members, I'll have Ms. Redwing answer the initial question.
And Ms. Redwing, if you can please introduce yourself, state who you represent, and so forth.
Great, thank you. I'm Joan Redwing, and I'm the Chief Enterprise Architect for Minute in the state of Minnesota. And what I have, so to answer, Madam Chair and members, I wanted to point out that, it, you know, your analogy is very close. What really is maybe a little bit of a tweak on it, I would say, is that we have decided to put a jacuzzi tub in that bathroom on the second floor, and we reinforced the floor on this side of the house and the foundation on this side of the house, but then somehow it got put on the other side of the house, right? Mm-hmm. And now you have a significant challenge because you have a jacuzzi tub that you can't fill up with water because it's too heavy, and you've got to leave it, you know, 3 inches of water is all you can put in that jacuzzi tub. Mm-hmm. So how did this happen? This happened a lot due to the structure of the team. The team was structured with two senior leaders, two managers, and then over 60 different developers that were from 45 contracting firms. So what you have is a tremendous amount of individual contributors that thought in their fair and fine understanding of what they were supposed to do and were working very diligently, but were not all rowing in the same direction.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Ms. Redwing, I think that we're on the same page here, and you and I have spoken a great many times. I guess that's probably one of my biggest points of disappointment, is that there was a tremendous and catastrophic lack of leadership on this project. And again, trying to describe things to people who ask questions, I go back to sometimes the analogy many of us have heard of, well, we have a room full of monkeys typing away at a typewriter, and we're praying that we get Shakespeare.
Yep.
We didn't get Shakespeare. And my question to continue down point number five is that you go on to articulate that the design testing was based on incorrect assumptions and zero adherence to the assumption that you did have. And I'm just trying to figure out how in the world we got to there. So I began looking at org charts over time because I want to ask questions, and I've asked personnel questions in the past, and we have two org charts that were both as of 9/24 and now after that, and I see a fairly frequently mentioned name of somebody named Sue Rohde on one of the pre-disastrous org charts. And anytime you see one person's name a lot of times on an org chart, that raises red flags for me that somebody is that apparently integral to the process that has fallen down. And I guess I'm just asking, who is Sue Rohde, and what happened? Is that, I mean, do we need to be concerned about that? What happened? Who is that? And apparently she's no longer still around, but I'm trying to figure out how could somebody who's going from the executive sponsor committee all the way down to the systems team and part of one of the scrum master teams, how did that person, what happened, I guess?
Maybe help us understand that. Commissioner?
Madam Chair and members, I don't know how that org chart was set up. It was before my tenure on the project, but I do know that Sue Rohde has left the project a couple weeks after launch and no longer on the engagement.
Okay. Representative Nash?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe we can talk about that offline, because we've had other personalities that were on the team, no longer on the team, been the subject of some fairly detailed news investigations and so on. We won't dwell on that today, but one of the other questions I have for you is, I asked you, I don't know, a week and a half, 2 weeks ago in my office prior to the beginning of session, the amount of money that you're asking for, $43 million, it's a lot of money. It's an eye-popping number. And I asked you a very detailed question that I've just now finally got the answer to, and I appreciate that, General and Mr. Eichten. Thank you for helping me get that. But it's about the burn rate. And the burn rate in layman's term is, how much money did you go through on a monthly or yearly basis to get the product that we have at hand? Now, your burn rate is, over 10 years, you spent plus or minus $100 million, if we can just use nice round numbers. Your burn rate has been approximately $1 million or $10 million a year. And we'll use a nice Minnesota ending to that too, ish. So $10 million-ish a year. And now you've come to us asking for $43 million to be spent on things in less than 24 months' time. Some of it in less than 6 months' time. And I'm still just curious and would like to be illuminated on the fact that how are you planning to do that mechanically? There has to be a way to say, we're going to spend this much money on this and this much money on that, because I have many friends who are chief technology officers and CISOs of household name companies, and they are friends of mine who I call on a regular basis. I'm like, okay, Factor Fertilizer, help me understand. And many of them says, Jim, you could grow a lot of tomatoes with what I'm seeing from what I shared with them. So if you could please help us, how do we spend $43 million when to date you've only been able to spend $10 million a year?
Commissioner or Ms. Redwing?
Madam Chair and members, I think your perception is right on that not all of the money that we're asking for is for our burn rate of contractors. Roughly, and just off top of mind, so I could be a little off, but just top of mind, from what we're expecting to spend from the burn rate of contractors is roughly $27 million of that money. And so that gets you to that $10 million a year-ish, right, with a bit of ramp-up and some $1 million of Microsoft Premier services. So we are in complete alignment with that, with your assessment. When it comes to what is remaining, a lot of that is infrastructure costs to build out our disaster recovery environment, which we do not have now. We do not have the disaster recovery environment, which is really important if the system were to go down in our data center, or our data center itself were to go down, not the system, because we have backups and redundancies in the data center now to keep it going. But if the data center were to go down, which is a pretty big if, it would take us weeks and weeks and weeks to restore the system to another site. So by having a disaster recovery environment, we could recover in minutes. And with a core function of government, you really need to have that capability. So part of that money is to build out that environment. And then there are some business costs as well. But when you look at our burn rate, I'm completely in alignment with your assessment.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to have more questions later. You'll learn to love me on that. I have lots of questions about this. So, again, back to the blueprint. Ms. Redwing, you just shared that we don't have a DR plan for this, which shocks me. From an infrastructural background, you also told me that it was under-spec'd at go-live. You had to throw a lot of CPU. Sorry, folks, that's some more nerdy terms, but you had to throw more horsepower at this. So, again, there was a fundamental breakdown in the specification requirements that you came up with, or not you, but that were devised at the time. And, again, I'm just trying to figure out how did we get there? Yes. Because for somebody who built the blueprint, it seems that they didn't understand what was going to be a requirement. And Ms. Redwing, you and I spoke in my office the other day. The new software has a tremendous amount of image storage requirements. From a storage guy's perspective, that means someone's going to be buying a lot of storage, mm-hmm. whether it's cloud storage, on-prem, hybridized, whatever. Mm-hmm. That was missed. Mm-hmm. That is unacceptable, folks. To have something that fundamental to the operation daily of the software, to not have that in place and to not have enough storage to handle multiple petabytes or zettabytes or whatever we want to use to throw at this, who fell asleep at the wheel there? And my other question is, so you said you had, you're looking at, you know, the disaster recovery, how do you fail over quickly? Seems to me, again, that should have been something that was addressed from day one or pre-day one, day zero. We didn't deal with that. So those two questions I would like answers before we move on to other testifiers.
Ms. Redwing?
Madam Chair and members, I would like to address the last question first. I think I forgot the first one already. But the one is, how did we miss the disaster recovery environment? I think that was the first one. How did we miss disaster recovery? And disaster recovery wasn't missed. It was always in the plan, and it was always spec'd out. It's only when the system came under fire after it was originally launched that the disaster recovery build-out got delayed as we were responding to the firefighting of addressing a system in trouble. And we still have that plan. We are still working on that plan. And part of the $10 million funding and the $43 million is to completely build that out. And then the resources that we would have used to build out that disaster recovery were consumed by that firefighting. A lot of those hours were. In terms of the data storage, we have enough data storage for MNLARS and enough database capacity for MNLARS, and I did go back and research all that after we talked. We have enough data storage. We just didn't have in that particular file enough allocated initially, and then when we saw that they were using three times the volume that was expected, we expanded it. So we did have it on hand, we just didn't have it implemented, and we didn't have monitoring on that table, which we now have. And so, but at the same point, when the system went live, there were programmatic problems in the system with the auto-generated code, with the kind of robotically generated code that made it run inefficiently. And one of the ways we solved that was throwing a tremendous amount of hardware at it to overcome those software problems. And I know, I'm sorry if I'm not connecting with everybody on that, but so part of it is we really overloaded the software to kind of make up for some of those shortcomings while we have Microsoft Premier and some of the tuning resources fix it on a permanent basis. So hopefully that answered your questions.
Yeah, Madam Chair. I get what's happened after the fact, and again, not trying to deal with what happened possibly years and months ago, but my question, and it causes me great concern, is when the decision was made to go live, it seems to me very clear that there was not, you used the best case scenario to test and not the worst case scenario, and anybody that's been in IT for longer than a week knows that you throw everything in the kitchen sink at it, trying to break it, blow it up, and melt it down, and then you fix it, and then you do it again and again and again, and that didn't happen. And I'm shocked. And Commissioner, if I could add that to a list of things to be thinking of for you, and I'm not trying to dictate the things that you should do in your job, but I'm blown away that there was that much of a conscious effort to not do that. And again, I've spoken to colleagues who are in Fortune 50 companies about this, and they're like, Jim, there's a problem there.
Madam Chair, Senator.
Don't downgrade me.
Representative Nash, I asked that question, and I think one of the answers is that they were doing project management audits, right? So do you have this checklist of certain things that have been done? But what they weren't doing is they weren't doing technical decision audits, which we all know is where the bread and butter is to make sure the plan actually works, right? We can make sure that we have all the right documentation. We can make sure that we're meeting the project goals. But unless someone can come in and say, are you making the right technical decisions? Is it subject to peer review, to cross-examination? Is it subject to multiple opinions? Then it doesn't really get you there. And so that is one piece that I believe was a failure. And I've actually talked to Ms. Redwing about a process that we are going to be instituting that includes that. When you step into the role of the business realm and validate the requirements, so when a business comes to you, a business partner says, here is what we want, there really wasn't a process for the IT realm, so for a minute, to come in and say, yeah, I hear what you're saying, but we don't agree with your assessment, and validate what you are asking for. And I think when we haven't done that before, and I think when the legislation worked on the consolidation, I really think that that's what the legislature meant, is they wanted us to validate those business requirements as opposed to what they're asking for in the minimal viable product that is being produced and designed, which includes, you know, the stakeholder analysis piece to it and the technical decision audits that go along with the needs and specifications of how it's designed. And then there's a third issue that really applies across the board, and that is a culture of being able to disagree. So when someone is making a decision, whether it's a business decision or a technical decision, there has to be an ability to have a frank and open conversation. Now, at the end of the day, the boss is the one who makes the decision because they are accountable and responsible for whatever the decision is. But there has to be a discussion of risks, of issues, of concerns, and an ability to not worry about backlash or being pushed aside for those concerns. And if you don't create that open environment, you get stovepiping where people are not told the truth or they're unable to go forward to explain what the ground truth is for fear that the people who are signing their paychecks are basically going to think of them differently, right? And so you have to create that conduit from the worker bees, the oversight of management of those contractors, the ability for people at any of those levels to raise those issues to the management and senior management to be heard. I do not believe, again, I know this is like day 19 for me, I do not believe that that was the environment. Again, at the end of the day, I am accountable and responsible for everything my agency does or fails to do. But that also includes ensuring that people can challenge my thought processes and feel safe to be able to indicate things are going wrong or are not thought of the way that they're supposed to be able to challenge your assessment. No one likes to be challenged in their technical decision-making skill sets. But the truth of the matter is you need that in order to make everyone aware of any concerns or risks in a project. That culture did not exist. I am building that culture, but it wasn't there previously.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the discussion and the opportunity to hear some of the historical perspectives on how this project has not worked out very well. And I appreciate Representative Nash's interest because he's obviously technically savvy, and I think that's useful for a committee. The question I have, I guess, is that we're at a point where we really need to, in addition to understanding the problems and failure, to move forward with a roadmap that's going to solve the problem for the citizens of Minnesota. And to that extent, I know we have a roadmap that's been put in place by the stakeholders and so forth, and you need money, funding today to move forward. Otherwise, it's pushing things even in a darker place as far as Menlars goes. So I guess I'm interested in knowing from you, Commissioner, what is the status, the need of the $10 million, and if that, how is that an integral to moving this project forward so that the problems that we're seeing now aren't further exacerbated?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, today at close of business, by close of business, I have to legally give 30 days notice to the contractors that are serving this project that I no longer have the funds to keep them on board. That is because I cannot use any money that I have dedicated to ensure that real ID timelines are met and that we are ready for rollout on October 31st for that project. So I can't use that money because I will not jeopardize my legislative mandate to ensure that rolls on October 31st. So today I have to give notice to those contractors. Those contractors require 30-day notice period that I have no longer funding to keep them on board. That $10 million provides a couple of things. One of them is to maintain the contractors that we need in order to ensure the vital fixes. It provides the ability for Microsoft Premier to come in and do the tuning of the data that we need them to do, and Ms. Redwing can talk about unhooking and what that all means, as well as an ability to ensure that we have the call center piece so that when the deputy registers are calling in and when the citizens of the state of Minnesota are trying to figure out what's going on with their titles or with the transfers, the tabs, and the plates, that they're not getting hung up on because the wait time is so long. It goes to all of those pieces.
Representative Johnson? Ms. Redwing?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, it also goes to complete the implementation of the disaster recovery environment. Without that funding, we have to stop work on that. It also keeps our test environments up and performance test environments up and running. Without that, we will have to disband the majority of those.
Representative Johnson, follow up.
Well, just a comment, Madam Chair, again, I hope that in addition to reviewing the problems that led to this, that we as a legislature also really put our nose to the grindstone and figure out how we can solve it so we can make this particular project move forward. And obviously that entails funding to pay for our contractors. So I don't know what you think, Representative Nash, but it just seems like something we need to do for the state. But you've been tracking this longer than I, so... Anyway, I just want to see this. I want to see this project move forward.
Yep. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. First of all, thank you for your service. And usually, somebody doesn't get to that level of service in terms of putting on that star without knowing something about leadership. And coming in to the Menlar and your new mission, and do you really have people within that organization, within Menlar, that you can really trust that they're going to do their job? And do you have also, the buck stops with you, but do you have the power to make those changes that has to be done? I know personally, my wife and I, we purchased a vehicle a few months ago and took over 6 weeks to get the title. In fact, the USAA is our insurance company, and they knew when I called them, they knew exactly what's going on here in Minnesota, and they're based out of Texas. So how are you going to handle the people that you're in charge of if they're not doing the job that they're supposed to be doing?
And, Commissioner, and just so you know, it is his birthday today.
Yeah.
Happy birthday to Representative Detmer. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, happy birthday.
Thank you. It's my wife's birthday, too, by the way. So.
Happy birthday to her.
Yeah.
Probably in trouble for not mentioning that first. In God we trust, all else we verify.
Yeah.
Simple as that. Faith alone is not enough in any position. People often want to tell you what you want to hear, not what you need to hear. Mm-hmm. Setting that culture again of, mm-hmm, I don't kill the messenger. And if you don't tell me the truth, once you violate that premise of truth and trust, you're out. You're done. You can't restore that. I have the power to do various things. I made it very clear when the governor asked me to take this position that that meant that I had full latitude to do whatever I needed to do, to ask whatever questions I needed to ask, and for ask whatever accountability I needed. And I was given that. I've already made some changes. I've already made some requests for those who have military background, IG support, Inspector General support. I have asked for a full legislative audit from the OLA to assist. I have made it clear that everything that occurs in my agency that I can share legally, meaning not subject to data privacy laws, will be shared to the fullest. I have nothing to hide. I got nowhere to go but up, right? I mean, that's just the reality of it. But I think when it comes with leadership, it's not easy to walk into any organization and expect it to change overnight. They have to learn to trust me as much as I have to learn to trust them. I may have the position of authority, but the respect that comes with that position will take time to earn, and that trust takes time to earn. I have made it very clear to my staff that I will underwrite honest mistakes. That's how we develop and grow, as long as we learn from those mistakes, and it is not an ethical or moral failing. I have no room for that within any organization. I do have due process requirements, meaning I can't just arbitrarily fire someone because I don't like the fact that they wore a blue tie today instead of a red tie, or they gave me the wrong answer for something, right? Everyone looks down at their ties. I'm sorry. I only said that because Representative Detmer is wearing a red tie, so I went with the reverse. But my point is that there needs to be an expectation of accountability. Something as simple as, and people think this is kind of funny, my stand-up meeting starts at 8:30. It does not start at 8:35. It does not start at 8:32. We're in our seats ready to go at 8:30. That sets a different culture. The why, challenging the why of the thought process, that is not within our normal DNA to do, but encouraging and allowing that. We'd not allow our technical people to challenge each other. So with that said, I understand where you're coming from. I will and hold people accountable where it is deserved and where it is appropriate. I do not believe in mass corporal punishment for the sake of making someone's head roll. But if you have done wrong in our organization, there will be consequences for that. Unfortunately, day two, I already had that discussion with someone who is no longer where they're supposed to be within my organization. Senator Detmer, I hope that answers your question.
Yeah.
Representative Detmer.
Madam Chair, and again, as representatives here, you know, we get the calls from our constituents. You know, they people around the state know that we've already spent our taxpayers have already spent $100 million on this project that started 10 years ago. And this is something that very serious, and it affects people across all different parts of our state. And it's something that we have to fix. And again, we know, as you know, where the buck stops, and that it has to be fixed. And we can't go on the way we're going on. Thank you, Mr. Madam Chair.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to get to the point of where we're looking at how do we get to functionality. I'm still waiting on answers to the questions that I asked before session started during one of the other committee hearings, but I keep hearing about, you know, celebrating we're down to, you know, a quarter million, you know, backlog. It'd be nice to understand what's a historic backlog, what's the, you know, running total and residency in the backlog. So that way we have a know when there's peak stuff happening. But what is the definition of acceptable and functional? Because to me, having hundreds of thousands in a backlog doesn't sound acceptable. So I'd like to know just how functional was the system before, how broke it is now. That could give us an idea on the environment we're working in. What quality systems and controls are in place? In previous discussions, it didn't appear as if they met even the minimal standards, you know, within the general industry. And those are the things that catch and prevent things from happening. You know, I still haven't seen any bug tracking charts, and I'd like to see the progress checkpoints and triggers that were in place before that didn't say, ooh, 3 months out, 6 weeks out, we aren't ready. I mean, those are the kind of things. So when we go forward, I see timelines in years instead of weeks and months, and that causes a pause to, even if we give you all of the funds you ask, how do we know that, you know, in a year or two, we're not going to be sitting here repeating it? Because in HHS committees, I've sat over years repeating the same questions in regards to software rollouts there. And I'd be more confident if in the design, I was told you've got functional blocks, you've got groups that define the boundary conditions so that you can fix a functional block independent and not cause everything else to be, you know, ruined. You know, it makes it easier to segment off the workload and actually make progress. You know, do you have parallel processing? Do you have in-situ computational functioning to speed up the process? And that then you can scale, have scalability on computational and, you know, storage, because, you know, those are real common and have been for years. What's the composition of your Tiger, you know, maybe you don't call it a Tiger team. What's the composition of your Tiger team? And is there independent oversight, so you have technical people that are not part of the team, so they have no skin in the game other than let's do the best job we can? And in the design reviews, what are they like? I mean, I'm used to, in the real world, design reviews where engineers come in and they help each other out by exposing flaws, weaknesses, and shortcomings. I don't think that I've gotten any indication that that's present in the current, you know, environment and system. You know, maybe there, you know, with the shakeup on top, it'll be straightening out. But again, I need confidence before I say, "Oh, here have millions and millions of taxpayer dollars to repeat the same mistakes." So I want to make sure that doesn't happen. You know, and I've been to some of the regional meetings with the stakeholders and heard those conversations. And to me, I am shocked that you didn't have a mirrored DB with VPN capabilities so that you could have alpha beta testing with some end users to be able to get a feel, because there's multiple environments out there and you need to have some from each. And I go, "Oh, gee, it breaks with you. It doesn't break with this one that we, the only one that we tested it with." And then, you know, data reconciliation. I haven't heard a great deal of confidence in how you're handling that, because the repetitive feedback of this is wrong, that's wrong, how do we change, you know, this, there's a great deal of churn. And if you don't have you know, a pretty good plan for that data reconciliation, you're going to propagate issues that maybe you don't find out until you come in to renew or you come in to sell. And frankly, those are not good customer feelings.
Ms. Wedling, did you want to comment any of that or just take it under consideration? You can always respond at a later time. I think you have Representative Quam has a host of questions, and maybe it would be best if you guys meet after or two. But if, any comments at all? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative, what I'd like to do is kind of offline get a list of some of the I couldn't write everything down that you had. And maybe I can get those all captured and then come back to you with a written response answer of where we are, where we were with some of those questions, because some are past questions and some are future questions, if that would be acceptable to you, Representative.
Representative Quam, is that okay?
Yes, that would. And the last thing is we really need to understand your design freeze process within the organization and who is in on the sign-up. You got to have end users signing off on the design freeze, and it's got to be back far enough. If I was with one of the major companies, I would be maybe reluctant to join, take a contract and work on a project with Minute, because I don't want to be in conjunction. My name's out there with a disaster. Mm-hmm. And so if we have better confidence that the people saying this is what we want, and you're not changing your change orders, churning through, and even the best of design teams can't work if you keep moving that goalpost. So those kind of things would help me feel more confident, and that's what I'm looking for.
Ms. Redwing, something to add?
Madam Chair and Representative Quam, I would add that one of your last questions was about data reconciliation. And just as many of the items you brought up, we have addressed on the team. And so I'm looking forward to preparing that answer. But from the data team's perspective, I do have a team that have built queries that go out and look for data in unusual states and go through the entire database. And we've remediated a lot of the data that's in an unusual state. And so I do have good analysis that I can show you on a lot of your concerns. So I'm looking forward to that.
Well, it sounds like you'll have a meeting.
Madam Chair, just when you do that, if you can give me a sampling of the logic triggers that you're utilizing in the query structure.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Great. I have a couple of questions going back to what Representative Nash was discussing on the whole $10 million that you are seeking and then this just the burn rate. Because as I kind of crunch the numbers based upon the data that you've provided, parses out the 551, that's 5.5 FTEs and so forth, and that includes the salary benefit space and so forth. What my question is pretty much the same as his, but I didn't feel that there was a response to that. All of these numbers are based off a year, but you are expecting to burn all of this money by June 30th. So how did you arrive at the $10 million figure when it's really, you're basing it off of 12 months versus the, 5 months or 4 months that we have left until the end of the fiscal year? Can you help me out on that?
Madam Chair, I believe that when we're looking at the numbers that we came up with, we expect the way that we kind of consume the dollars to be kind of like a snake eating a rat, in that we're going to ramp up hard on a number of key resources, and then we're going to ramp down when they've solved some of the problems. And one of the things is there's not a lot of people out there at any given time in IT that are just available. And so we looked at how many people could we reasonably expect to bring on board given the time frame. So if we start recruiting in a week or tomorrow, and we start recruiting in tomorrow, what reasonably could we recruit? And that's where we came to with our burn rate, our target burn rate of 1.4 for the $10 million, and then it would probably go up awarded the $43 million so that we could get the rest of our team complement, and then it would ramp down in the 19 timeframe as we've completed the big chunks of our roadmap. If you see on our roadmap, there's a lot of concurrent activities, and then it dwindles down to less concurrent activities at the end of the roadmap. So when we have our maximum concurrency is where we need the maximum amount of people.
But under that scenario, you wouldn't need the full $10 million as this upfront amount that you're asking for, because in essence what you're saying is you're looking for this money to extend into fiscal year 19 and that you're looking for this to be a ramp-up. But even if you were to take into consideration your June 30th deadline that this is what you need the money for, the problem that you have is what you identified is finding the people that can actually fill these roles. And based upon the history of the agency in spending this money, you were doing $10 million on a yearly basis. How can you expect to hire those people, keep those people, in the time frame from now until June 30th? Because the math for me just doesn't add up.
And so that $10 million includes $2 million for the business. It includes building out our disaster recovery environments and our physical environments. It also – oh, I forgot to say Madam Chair. Sorry, Madam Chair.
You're good. That's all.
Okay.
That's the House, but not the Senate.
Okay. and it also includes building out a disaster recovery environment. It includes $1 million for Microsoft Premier to come in. It includes additional consulting costs. So when you put all of that together, it does add up. And so we did factor into going from an $880,000 a month burn rate to a $1.4 million a month burn rate, knowing that we couldn't ramp up as high as we wanted to, and then building out all those expenditures so we finish the build-out so we have disaster recovery and all those components up and running. So there's hardware as well as people.
Here's what we're going to do. And what I'm asking from the commissioner is I want I don't know if it needs to be a week by week, but a month by month until June 30th, how you expect to spend this $10 million. Because I still don't have confidence that it's actually going to happen, given the past history that it took a full year, a full 12 months versus 5 months to spend this kind of money. So that's just one item that I'm looking for greater detail. Then I want to go to the letter that you had submitted to, or all the agencies had submitted to, Representative Torkelson and Representative Baker. Members, again, this is in your packet. It's February 23rd is the date of the letter. And I'm going to start with the item number one. It's the overview of the new request. And so I've been looking through all of the numbers that have been provided in this and then comparing it to the numbers in the spreadsheets. I've gotten many spreadsheets. And quite honestly, I haven't found a single such spreadsheet that actually matches another one. Every single one has been different. And that raises some concerns or kind of red flags to me. These numbers keep changing, and I get a little nervous about that and what that means as do we really have a good handle on what the financial implications are of this, and are these really actual real numbers? Are these wishful numbers? I kind of feel like this is the fictional pot of gold at the end of the rainbow and that we're just not going to have any results, but we're going to spend a lot of money doing it and have fun going to the rainbow. So I just want to kind of get some comfort because right now I really don't. So I'm going to start with I'm going to look at the paragraph that starts with of the $42.8 million request in fiscal year 19. And in there you have a number that's $10.344 million. Okay? And then when I look at the spreadsheet here, and I don't know how to describe the spreadsheet members, but it should be in your packet. At the top it has the revenues. Then it has a section on incurred or fixed costs. Then it has a section on driver, and then it has a section on vehicle. And when you look at that, I tried many different ways of how to calculate those numbers to get to the number that you have in here of 10.34. I even added back numbers from fiscal year 18, thinking maybe it was just a typo, and I still couldn't get to that right number of the 10.344. So help me out. Why doesn't the spreadsheet match the letter? What happened in between? Which one should I be going by? And I'm concerned. The numbers are not adding up. Mr. Eichten?
Madam Chair, for the record, John Eichten, Minute Legislative Director. So I believe you're talking the first sentence of the second paragraph under question number one of the $4.28 million in FY19. $10.344 would fund DVS customer service needs and DVS to support the driver and vehicle systems. So to walk that back, what's the other spreadsheet you're looking at?
Using this spreadsheet, tell me where the numbers are. And you help them out.
Okay. So you would look under, Madam Chair, you would look under driver, that the middle box, DVS customer service, the $195,007.8 million. Then you would look under vehicle for DVS staff, the $771,000, and the $1.322 million.
John, I'm going to have you back up. Excuse me, Mr. Eichten, can you back up again? So you're talking at the driver DVS customer service of 7832, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, what was the next one that you said?
Madam Chair, the $195,000 and the $7.832 million. The both years.
No, just fiscal 19.
Okay. So you want to look under the fiscal 19 column, under driver, Madam Chair.
Start from scratch. Start over.
I am. Okay. Under the fiscal year 2019 column, the driver bucket.
The very beginning.
The fast DVS staff of $1.19 million in fiscal year 19. The DVS customer service, $7.832 million. And under vehicle, the DVS staff, $1.322 million. How do we do it? Is that up to Madam Chair?
Okay. So now we finally get the number. Great. That helps. That's just to give you an idea, Commissioner, that's kind of the level of detail. This should match with this. I got to tell you, I went around this several different times trying to figure out where that dollar figure came from. And then the other one that I want to ask you, Mr. Eichten, is if you go down further on that sentence, on the left-hand column, the word on the outside is scanners, and then in parentheses it says total of $1.228 million. Again, I couldn't find that on the spreadsheet, so can you tell me where I would find that on the spreadsheet?
So that would be within, I believe, and I would ask MMB to correct me if I have this wrong, but I believe it would be in the DVS customer service bucket in FY 2019 because that bucket included not only staff to staff the PIC line, the public information center line, so the customer service line, it also included some technology upgrades for the PIC, for the customer service center, to better handle and route calls and use email tools or IM tools to allow people to get their answers more quickly and perhaps do some self-service.
Okay, so here's what I think that we need. I need you to actually give me a spreadsheet that has all of that detail broken out.
So, Madam Chair, did you receive the spreadsheet that came about
an hour ago? Yes, I did.
Are you looking for a level deeper than that? Even?
I am.
Okay.
Yep.
We can work on that. So down to perhaps, you know, the number of scanners that level? Is that what you're looking
for? Yes, so we'll get a detail of it all, what this includes, because I wasn't connecting that the total of the 1.228 was part of the actual 7832, and so I need to see what comes out of that amount. Does that make sense?
Yes, ma'am.
Especially when there's I've got two different documents and just trying to match them up. I just want one fail-safe, this is it, this is the item, and that at the end of the day, the totals amount match what you're saying, okay?
Absolutely.
Then the other one is I am looking at, help me understand the difference on the 1.19 for the 14 people, and it says it's the DVS fast staff. So are we funding the fast staff, or are we funding DVS people, or how does that work? And are you able to answer that? Maybe not.
Madam Chair, I'm able to answer that.
Okay.
So in any project, any big IT project like this, where you're building software or implementing COTS software, as we're doing with fast, commercial off-the-shelf software, you need DPS, DVS staff to inform that implementation, to work alongside the FAST people to ensure that their tool, which is an off-the-shelf tool, is going to be customized or retrofitted to meet the needs of DVS business. So there are some DVS staff who are being paid for there.
And Mr. Eichten, that wasn't part of the FAST contract at all?
No, the contract, we don't. They say when we sign the contract, Madam Chair, that we estimate this number of staff is going to be needed from your internal IT department, it's a minute, and your business staff in order to make this implementation successful. And that is customary.
Okay. And then I'm looking at the next paragraph. Again, it starts off with a $48.2 million request, fiscal year 19, $1.875 million. In there, it says that it's a total of nine staff with a mix of contractors versus a minute folks. Why does that amount increase in the tails? So you start at 1.875, but when you actually look in the tails, I think it's at 2 million. Why? So if you're looking at that spreadsheet.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I see 2 million in 20 and 21. I'm going to phone Ms. Redwing here.
Welcome again, Ms. Redwing.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. So it goes up in the tails because part of the FAST contract, part of working with the FAST vendor, is that they recommend that they leave behind some FAST resources from their company that we add to our team to make customizations to the software post the release. So they say it's customary for you to have a couple people on board in a maintenance phase in case you have legislative requirements that you have to change the software, or in case you have to do maintenance for the software and regular upgrades. Because we're buying an off-the-shelf software, there are going to be regular upgrades. And because it's proprietary software, we don't get the source code. So we have to have people who have the skill set to make those changes.
So these are bodies versus?
Versus we pay a flat fee when we're constructing, uh-huh. And then we pay bodies longer term year after year.
And Ms. Redwing, are they going to be permanently here, or are they, or do they have other obligations with the FAST business?
Madam Chair, after speaking to the FAST people, they are permanently here, and we have a FAST application here at Revenue, and they have FAST people permanently here.
Okay. Well, let's talk later about how the mechanics of that work and what that means for state government. Okay. But I'd also like a breakdown of that. And for all of the tails, I want to know exactly what the tails are going for. Okay. Next question that I've got is I am looking at, later on, it's the last paragraph of Section 1. And it has a list of different items that you're going to pay for. You've got the servers and the data storage and so forth. You also have workstations. Define to me what a workstation is.
Well, I can define what a workstation is. I just don't know how many are in here. So, Madam Chair, workstations are the laptops and desktops that people use to do their work.
Okay. I think it would be helpful for us to get the numbers for all of that, too, and parse it out as well. As well as everything else, because I was talking to Representative Nash on this issue, too, and we were kind of curious about the idea of why we're going with servers and not utilizing the cloud as an option for the state, and the fact that that's going to be more affordable versus doing this option.
And Madam Chair, the full ask does include not only migrating our disaster recovery to the cloud, which is our first step, but then migrating our application to the cloud as well.
And what happens to the servers then that you purchase under here?
They go back to the data farm to be reused.
Okay, and so are you reflecting that savings in your financials here?
There's a chargeback reduction because it's billed by utilization, so it wouldn't be a savings of the actual server; it would be a chargeback reduction to DVS.
Okay, all right. Then the other thing, too, I am looking, I'm not sure if you guys are able to answer this, but maybe from commissioner to commissioner, you can discuss this with DPS or DVS, too. I am looking on the 63 permanent DVS staff for the PIC. Uh, when I look at this amount of people, aren't we in essence trying to fund something off of this $10 million that really should go in a regular request to the legislature? Can you help me out on that piece? Or is this in, is it, or is this part of the $43 million?
Madam Chair, we should get that from DPS, I think, directly.
Okay. I think that would be helpful. And then another question that I had, I noticed that you have staff funding that is going to the Department of Revenue or went to the Department of Revenue. Can you talk to me a little bit more about that? Why is the Department of Revenue getting funds from you guys for MNLARS? Ms. Redwing.
Madam Chair, that is because we actually had volunteers from the Department of Revenue. This is another DPS question. I would take a stab at it with apologies to my colleagues. They helped us out during title processing.
As far as in what? Can you give me greater detail on that, please?
Madam Chair, so I want to caution that this was an arrangement with the Department of Public Safety and Driver and Vehicle Services, not Minute. Minute really had no role in this.
Sure.
If you'd like me, I can try to
if you
tell
feel
you what
more
I know.
Comfortable, Mr. Eichten, you can always just get back to me with that response. I'd rather that you be accurate than not.
Yep. Okay? Well, I can tell you that there was an interagency agreement between the departments to assist with title processing.
Okay.
And that's all I can say confidently. We can get you any other information you want.
I think what would be helpful for me to know is how long that took place,
yep.
How many staff, all those kind of nitty-gritty details. So if you can get that to us as well. And then the other question, too, and again, Commissioner, I'm putting you on the spot on this. I look at all of this, and I wonder, you had – not just one agency, not just one commissioner. You had three different commissioners that were signing off on all of this, all of the money. You had the MMB who signed off on the ultimate. We had the commissioner of Minute. We had the commissioner of DPS all sign off on this budgeting. And it, to me, it's hard to understand when you have three agencies involved that you would come to us then as a legislative body on March and say March 1st, absolutely deadline. Sorry, we need this urgently. To me, that just doesn't speak about the agency that you're taking care of, but it speaks to a system-wide problem that we have in the state, that we have three commissioners that said that this was okay to do, and then strong-arm, what I feel is strong-arming the legislature to say, you got to get this done because the sky's going to fall otherwise. I have a really tough time with that. And I realize that you're new in your position, but I would recommend that you take that back to the other commissioners. I will be having that conversation with them as well. But I think it's a really hard sell to the Minnesotans of this state. I got to tell you, the constituents that I talk to, oof, they are burning mad. And they're burning mad because they see this, the government that they spend money on in a very generous fashion, that this is just an utter failure. I can't imagine that. If I was in that role, there is no way in a million years I would have signed off on that and said it was okay, knowing that it was going to run out of funds. It's just irresponsible financial management. And that's more of a comment, not a question, really. We've got a couple other folks that want to ask some questions. Representative Uglum.
Thanks, Madam Chair. First of all, I got to apologize. I was a little late here today. It's in public safety. We had a rather robust hearing in public safety. And secondly, I was going to ask a number of questions, but you have covered them extensively and done a wonderful job. I think it just goes to the depth of the problem here. You guys have a tremendous job ahead of you, so we'll leave it at that. But I, too, am also very, very concerned. We get one day's notice, hey, we need $10 million. It's not a good way to do business. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Uglum, Representative Lilly.
I think you
have a comment, Madam
Chair.
Representative Lilly.
I wasn't sure if the testifier had a comment.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Eichten or Commissioner, have a response or no?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to speak to the announcement. I don't want to leave you with the impression, Representative Uglum, that this came forward yesterday or the day before, the announcement about the roadmap and the need for some action early in session occurred on January 31st. I recognize even January 31st is an extremely short period of time to be asking the legislature to take action by March 1st, but I just wanted to make sure you had an understanding of the timeline there. And we've been going over that with the chairs involved as well. So.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Mine's more of a kind of a general comment or an observation of where we're at. And things are bad, I mean, clearly, and I think I'm not against discussing that and figuring that all out and working on it. But for us to ignore the 5 p.m., the cliff that's ahead of us is a little disappointing to me if we are indeed going to do that in the end of the day. I hope that we can have some movement. For those of us that have concerns, there's been a change in leadership, and I was glad to see Representative Detmer's question, and the answer of the commissioner was like, wow. So, it's hard not to respect what's going on. I could see your eyes, and I got a feeling you believe them. What she's saying, and I think you'd be there at that 8:30 meeting. I know I would be. So there's been heads that have rolled. There's things that are moving. They're done. This clearly is a great hire. There's some continued, obviously, concern. We all have registrars in our area. We're all concerned about auto sales. Just on and on and on. And then I'm sure we're all, I work in a big business that's impacted by the driver's license issue, so I have concerns there, but I'm confident that we can figure it out. I was hoping that we wouldn't need an extension, so I was a little surprised with that pending out there, but I hope we can figure all that out. But for us to sit here and think that these things don't happen in reality is quite naive. And Mr. Nash, Representative Nash, I appreciate that you talked to the top 50 businesses, but I can go through lists of Minnesota businesses that have had trouble. Today I deposited a check from a major Minnesota company that sells coffee. I got a $68.56 check in the mail from a lawsuit of computer breaches or errors that this company made. I didn't really know what when I got the check in the mail, I was reminded that I had signed a card about 2 months ago about being a party to this in violation. And so I got a check in, and I used my fancy little phone to deposit into my credit union. But these things are common. I don't know if anybody's I was hoping Quam was still here, but one of my favorite movies is that Hidden Figures. And we had this all these smart women that were figuring out numbers and working them. And then all of a sudden this famous Minnesota company comes in with a computer, but they didn't send anybody to know how to run it or to figure it out. That's business reality. And then these same ladies figured out how to run the darn thing. And now things have changed. But it wasn't an easy transition, and to say it as such is a little disappointing. Things are bad. Heads are rolling. Think about Hawaii, for goodness sakes. Missiles are coming in. Talk about living on a little island and you've got missiles coming in, and to think that these things aren't real. None of us are excited about this. I feel sorry for the people losing their jobs, but, I'm glad you're taking care of it. I said that about a week ago on the House floor. If we have people that aren't doing a good job, then there's got to be transitions. I'm pretty proud of the governor, I think, in this hire. She seems pretty top-notch to me. And I'd like to have one of you come up to me later and tell me what you think that she isn't doing or trying to do right. Or even say it here if you got the guts. I think we're on a path to success, and it's bad. Heads rolled. We know that, but let's figure it out. that's what we're here for. I mean, I don't know how. I mean, you guys can do your lit or whatever you need to do. You know, Leon Lilly screwed up and sent out the flyer. You know, you can't get your driver's license because Leon Lilly or whatever. That's fine. But, you know, at the end of the day, let's fix this. Let's figure it out. And I know, please don't say that this doesn't happen in industry. My goodness sakes. I mean, I think of a, I mean, just, I could go through a whole list. I could spend like hours on that if you want to. And I'll buy you a coffee on my check here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. And that reminded me, too, we had a conversation last night, got a chance to meet for the first time, and one of the questions that I asked for you was, what is your game plan moving forward? And you've got this $43 million mark that you've put in place, but I really don't have the what I would consider a comprehensive plan of what that looks like from a budgetary perspective in particular. I'm looking for, again, to the level and degree of nuts and bolts detail on the finances. Because, again, if you're asking for this, this is not something that I think that we should commit the citizens of Minnesota to without actually knowing the details. Because despite in recognition of Representative Lilly's comments, the difference, though, between the private sector and the public sector is that we are responsible for the tax dollars of Minnesotans. And I take that job really seriously because it's like that time when you get volunteered to be the treasurer for some organization. Nobody wants that job, right? Well, that's our job. That's our responsibility. And we need to take it seriously and do due diligence for the people that can't be here every day because they have jobs and they're working hard and paying taxes. With that, I've got Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I have, and for the testifiers, I apologize. I've had constituents who have pulled me in and out of the committee meeting here today, and maybe some of this has been covered, but if so, great, I'll underscore that. If not, let me offer this then as a fresh idea today. First, a couple of comments, then I would like to get the commissioner's perspective on a question. For starters, a number of years ago, we started building that system called MinSure, and we were a critical thing for folks. Health insurance costs, being able to get affordable health insurance, getting affordable care, and that system got rolled out, designed in-house here in the state of Minnesota. And we had some budget overruns, and the system didn't work, and we were kind of telling people, well, when you put stuff in, You're really not putting it in. Somebody on the other end is taking this data, and they're downloading it, and we're handling that data twice, which is very costly and very repetitive to be able to do that. And we still have trouble. I still get calls from people with MinSure. The system's not working. They get questions on some of the operational sides, not necessarily the technology sides anymore. But they still do have some problems and some glitches and some system overloads. So we kind of work our way through that, and the public goes, okay, it can happen to anybody. Now we're at MinLARS, and I really fear anything that has Min in front of it that comes out these days because, you know, it's just question marked in my mind. What, you know, it might be a Min stake, I don't know. But stepping back to the conversation, so now we've got MinLARS. So what's the second thing that people want to be able to do? Well, they want to be able to register their vehicle so they don't get pulled over by officers who go, well, you know what, we thought your vehicle was a stolen vehicle. We come to find out that you sold that car 2 weeks ago, you transferred the plates, and we ran it. It didn't tie into a 2018 Buick. It tied into some other vehicle, so we didn't know for sure what was going on. To me, that's unnecessary harassment of people who are just kind of trying to do their job. And the issue with the registrars. So this has a lot of ripple effects within Minnesotans. And within the way we do business. And I've actually had people who said, why don't we just eliminate the whole license transfer thing, increase the amount of money that people would end up paying in a sales tax, and just do away with the whole thing. And when you sell your vehicle, you just update the title and the plates stay with the vehicle. Why are we even worrying about those kinds of things if it's a revenue thing? So this is really hitting home in my district with folks. So those as the preface comments. Being new into the process, Commissioner, what I'd like to know from you, fresh eyes on a stale topic here in the state of Minnesota that's got a bit of a history with it, what kind of a process would you use going forward that would say, you know what, this is what we can do with our technology and with our education, with our skill set in the state of Minnesota, versus we really should start knocking on the door of a provider who's maybe worked in 50 of the 49 of the other states or other areas to be able to leverage those kinds of things, and then ask them, how can we modify and customize that to the state of Minnesota? to Representative Lilly's point, private sector goes, hey, where else can I solve this? So if they are doing those kinds of things, scale it up, scale it down, leveraging it. I just don't want to have the third time's the charm when we finally got it right when we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars going forward. I realize that my comments, my question are kind of maybe long-winded, but I just really have a tough time with that. And so if you can comment about kind of giving your state of the minute address for us about how we avoid this in the future.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, I've been thinking about this process because a lot of it is about processes, not just that, you know, can you do it technologically wise, but what are the processes to discover it? Remember, we did contract this out to private industry both times, and we had to bring it back in-house as a result. And that's a challenge when you're looking to do things that doesn't exist in the regular commercial realm just yet. When I look at where we were with MNLARS and the process, I can tell you the things we didn't do correctly, not all of them yet, but just the initial assessments of what we didn't do. And the first thing is we didn't do an adequate job in the needs assessment. What is it that the business user is seeking to do? Who are the stakeholders? Do they agree that this is what they need to do? Now, this is a business function. This is not a minute function, right? I'm the tech piece to it. But we need to insert ourselves under the centralized model to say, look, this is what you're telling me you want to do, but where are the stakeholder inputs so that we're not developing a minimally viable product that doesn't meet the end user's needs because we haven't done the right homework to design it, right? Because no matter what, if you tell me you want me to design a square and I design you a square, but what you really needed was a triangle, I can't go back and then make it work right. I got to cut off corners to now make it a triangle, and it may not look like a pretty triangle when I'm done. But if I had known after talking with you and getting the assessments correct that what you really were talking about is you needed a triangle, then we're in business. And then what we need to be doing is we need to have multiple layers of technical assessment, right? So we have the business plan, but now we have to have the technical plan. And we have to have people who can challenge the assumptions. Now, this is hard. I'm a lawyer by trade, right? What I think the case in chief is, I might have three other different attorneys who have an entirely different opinion on how we should proceed with this case. But that discussion back and forth at the technical piece, we were missing that. And then what we need is we need an oversight at the executive level of people who have the technical skill for these business technology partners who are basically the men and employees who are in each of the departments to come back and to talk about the assessments of where they're at, to have the project leaders talk to those project managers about, okay, let's look at the priorities, let's look at the milestones, look at where we need to be, and then hold them accountable. We haven't got that process in place. We don't have the ability to challenge back in early warnings. And then creating, by the way, also the ability to understand each of our skill sets. It is hard to retain, to attract, first off, quality IT, and to retain quality IT when you can make significantly more in the outside environment in basically a zero unemployment field, right? And so what are we doing culturally to keep people as well, that they want to stay within our formations, that we're professionally and personally developing them so their skill sets continue to grow and they continue to grow as people within our organization? Their value adds, not just people sitting at their desk doing the same old thing and not adding additional resources or capabilities to our formations, right? And then there's a real assessment where we sometimes will have to look and say, we don't have the capability in-house to do this, and we're going to have to contract that out. And then we got to be tight about our contracting procedures to make sure that if someone doesn't deliver, I have a single choke point to go after to enforce that contract and get what we need back out of it if they fail to do what they were supposed to do.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, I do appreciate your explanation on this, and that helps me maybe to understand what happened in Minshew and what's happened in Menlars. We didn't have tight specs, and we, when in sales, they say, so what are you looking for? And the salesperson really can't show you what you want unless you've been very articulate in what you're looking for. And I'll use a vehicle. I want a four-door, I want a two-door, I want a this, I want a that. And so it's really hard to be able to go out and say, well, do you want this? Well, no, I wasn't really thinking about an SUV. Well, unless you get that communication. So it maybe helps me to understand that we weren't clear when we went out to the vendor and said, well, what are you looking for? And they're asking us for the specs on this. And we said, well, it's just not working. Let's bring it back internally. And we didn't internally know what we wanted either. So I'm hearing that there might have been redundancy of effort, which also as Representative Nash said earlier, really triggered the burn rate of dollars that went through this project and possibly Minshew as well. I don't know if there's a question follow-up, but that's just what I heard. And so maybe the commissioner wants to either clarify or validate that my assessment on that was right.
Commissioner, any response?
Madam Chair, Representative, semi-correct. Even if you give all the specifications in the world, quality control and a failure to live and have to be careful because of the legal implications of that. If a vendor isn't doing the quality, what they claimed they were capable of doing, there comes a time where you don't continue to waste money and you shut that off and you hold them accountable through those clauses within the contract. And that's just kind of the reality. Sometimes there's only a vendor or two that can do what you're asking them to do or that tells you, yeah, we can do that based off of what the design is, but then they don't deliver. And that's where that accountability comes in and being able to take those ramifications we need to with contractors and hold them to tight contracts that have things like clawbacks and damages and performance measures in them.
You know, I think given what Representative Driscoll has talked about, the Menlars, Minshew, I mean, Minute doesn't have a great track record when it comes to this. I think what I'd ask you to do, Commissioner, is when you are delving into kind of the entire structure of the agency, is this really the right role for Minute? Or do we need to rethink how Minute operates and what their responsibilities are for the state? So no comment. I'm not looking for a comment on that right now. So I've got Representative Nash, Olson, and Ward. So we've got about 10 minutes left. Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and that look you gave me was be brief, Nash. So I'll get right to it. And to Representative Lilly.
Yes, sir.
It's well known business has failures, but I think the comparison is fair that some of the businesses that you see have single points of failures. We've had multiple points of failures here. So I won't debate that here, but Commissioner, and possibly Ms. Redwing, you and I had a conversation on the way in today where we talked about a semantical difference of opinion on outages versus blue screens of death, and I wanted to talk about that because some of our deputy registrars have had significant debilitating outages in their mind, and we'll just call it the spinning wheels of death, or where they can't actually have the system function to the point where they can perform something at the window for a customer. They'll use the word outage. You'll disagree with that because your reporting structure says back, we're straight green, we're good to go, something is happening along the way. My question is this. Will you please help create the lingua franca or the Rosetta Stone that you and I talked about so that when we're talking about what deputy registrars are screaming at us about, that they have these inabilities to perform work, and they call those outages, where they have to shut their doors perhaps because they can't do the work the customers need with the software that we require them to use. Can we figure out how that's going to be communicated to them? Because I talk to deputy registrars sometimes daily, sometimes the same registrars daily, and they yell at me, and I'm taking it because I signed up for this, which is insanity. But we need to do a better job of communicating to those people why they can't do what we need them to be able to do. So as the designers of the software now, as the people who are making the software work, have we gone down the road of helping them understand where the breakdown is? Because I know Ms. Bailey has gone all over the state, but I'm hearing that they don't want that. They want an actual clinical breakdown of why the stuff doesn't work. They want it to be, to use Representative O'Driscoll, they want it to be mintastic. They want it to work because this is what we provided them, and it doesn't. So, Commissioner, can you help me understand what the approach is? Because I know that you've looked at that. Help me understand what you're going to do.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, one of the things that I noticed, I've said this, day two of the job, I went down to Scott County and talked to the deputy registrars down there and went basically in the front lines to see what they were looking at and what they were seeing. I was actually afraid to step foot into the courthouse at that point because I wasn't sure what I was going to be facing. There was not clear communication, and we have a better job to do. One of the things that has occurred is we have started a much more frequent communication, daily communications out to the deputy registrars, explaining what's going on, the fixes, what's coming up, expectations. But I hear that I need to do even better about explaining things such as what we view as an outage versus a slowdown in performance. Perception is reality. When you're sitting at the screen and they're yelling at you, you don't care if I say it's not an outage, it's a performance slowdown. All you know is you can't serve the person in front of you, and that's not fair to them. I signed up for this. It's okay to yell at me. It's not okay to yell at them as a result of stuff that we're doing. And so that said, I have instructed our teams, and we're working a combined effort with DPS to solidify our communications back to the deputy registrars. Is it perfect? No. Has it gotten far better in the last 3 weeks? Yes. Do I have far more to go? Absolutely.
Madam Chair.
Representative, now are you going to give us brief or Nash brief?
Ouch. Wow. Now I'm going to cry. Well, no, I don't.
I'm just teasing.
Ms. Redwing, you and I have spoken frequently about this, about fixes that beget greater problems. And briefly, since the Chair has lovingly nudged me to do that, can you help us understand that we are doing a better job at our testing before we roll out these fixes, because that has been a pernicious problem for many. And you know, they're viewing this as a giant goat rodeo, I believe I called it before, and they want to know what you're doing to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Commissioner, Ms. Redwing.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, I had to Google goat rodeo. I didn't know what it was.
It's a great word.
We have upped our testing game significantly. We've done a couple of really important things. We've instituted full regression suites. So before, they were trying to do a targeted test on the architecture underpinnings, which we know some of those architecture areas are weak, some are strong. And if you think that you've got good coverage and you rely on the architecture, it's a bad assumption. So we have more than quadrupled our testing coverage. We've also ensured that we adhere to a very, very strict code cutoff. I think I had heard before the code cutoff is really important. We need to cut off code and then give the testers time to test on a stable system. We can't just keep adding fix and fix and fix and then having them not pick up in the middle because there's a chance that they could miss something. So we have done a tremendous amount of improvements around the testing process. We no longer rely on our automated testing as our sole regression suite. We do rely on our automated testing, but we augment it with a very large manual suite. We've upped our test environments to include proper test data that mirrors production in data quality and data size. We've upped our test scenarios in performance engineering so that we are testing the same paths through the system that are heavily traveled by the deputy registrars, and that we have upped our performance test environment to be a clone of production, and then we've cloned that data. So no longer are we comparing apples to oranges before we launch. We're comparing apples to apples.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm good for now. I'll have a lot of questions later, and I believe the Commissioner and I are going to be meeting in my office. But thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I sound like a broken record probably on some of this stuff, but we've spent a lot of time in this committee today, and not just this committee, but a lot of committees that other people sit on, talking about Minlars and what went wrong. And we read the paper, and we continue to dig, we continue to ask questions, which I think we need to do, but I think there's an underlying way that we have these conversations in this committee and state government that undermines that there's not a belief. I'm under the belief that our government agencies can deliver really good things for the people of Minnesota. That's a fundamental belief I have. I don't know that we all share that belief all the time, and I still believe that's true, and I believe we can do it, and we have talented people that can solve problems for the state of Minnesota, that can take what's gone wrong and fix it. I actually have that belief in our people, and I'll always have that belief. And so we continue to have conversations in this committee that don't start in that place, and I think it's hard to solve these problems when we don't start there together. So I want you to know I'll work with you and believe you have the talent and the smarts and the ability and can put together a budget and a roadmap that I think this legislature can get behind. I'm there with you. And I think we continue to look at what's wrong, and we bring Minshew up time and time again as a failure. Minshew's going well right now, contrary to what everybody's saying. I'd like to say that in my office, you know who I get the most frequent calls about? Not Minshew when someone's having a problem with their health care. It's navigating the insurance companies. Mm-hmm. That's where it comes from when I hear from my people in my district. So I just want to clear up, it's not always government failures that gets us to where we're going, but when there are, we do need to address it. But I believe in a better version of who we are, and I'm willing to work with you on that.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lots of good ideas and interesting conversations. I have not been really closely involved in either Minshew or Minlars, any of the Min kinds of things. But what I have learned from observing over these years is there doesn't seem to be a realistic expectation for doing these jobs in a time frame. And I feel like all the plans are really missing not just the landmarks and objectives and goals, but putting them in a realistic time frame. And then we have legislators coming in and out of the process, and I think we don't spend enough time asking all the questions like Chair Anderson is asking and wanting the big picture and wanting the details, but also put those on a realistic timeline so we have a better understanding, and it's not just going to be done. It sounds really good. Let's go and get it done, and then you come back in 2 weeks and say it's not done. Why not? I think sometimes we're not being very realistic and fair if we're not also including that. So I would like to see a really comprehensive plan that includes time that's needed to do some of these things with the appropriate understanding of what our capacity is. So you'd said sometimes you need to go to an outside vendor. That's going to take time to figure out if that vendor can actually make the square that you're looking for instead of the triangle you thought you were looking for. And so I think part of where we break down is not understanding the time frames that are needed and not getting enough feedback when things come up.
Members, those are the only questions I have at this point. I think, Commissioner, we gave you a whole laundry list of to-do list, if you will. We'll probably have some further conversations about it, but the soonest that you can give us that information, if you contact John Holquist, he'll be able to disseminate that information to the committee as a whole, and will help us guide us forward on this whole process. So appreciate your time and look forward to talking with you again soon. With that, members, we are adjourned.